Well, thanks, Elizabeth, for a very generous introduction. Can I too acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to elders past and present. I wanted too to acknowledge people in my occupation past and present, particularly Max Corden and Craig Emerson, who are here tonight. Can I thank too Bill Griffiths for originally inviting me to give this lecture under circumstances he and I imagined a little different from what we're in tonight, and also to acknowledge David as well for his kind words. I wanted to say it's a real pleasure to be delivering this year's John Freeburn Lecture in Public Policy, and to note too that usually named lectures are given for people who've passed away. I have to say that personally it's much nicer to do things this way around. As Woody Allen once noted, I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality by not dying. I don't want to live on in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live on in my apartment. And John Freeburn's not just very much alive, he's also doing excellent work on topics of first order importance, continuing to publish regularly in refereed journals. Something that's, let's face it, pretty impressive for a person who is in his fifth decade of research. When I was a visiting academic at Melbourne University Economics Department, John was a terrific colleague, generous with his time, insightful with his comments. He's one of the people I draw on as a parliamentarian. When I want to test ideas, we'll look for new ones. Australian public finance is better for John's careful insights, and it's a true honour to be delivering the Freeburn Lecture tonight. Now, my topic tonight is the relationship between competition policy and inequality. If I were still an economics professor, I would have a plethora of PowerPoint slides to now dive into. And it's true, I've got a picture and graph or two to share with you. But because I'm a parliamentarian, let's start with a story. In 1992, packaging businessman Ed Zak started cardboard box manufacturer Zakpak with a leased factory in Caringbah and then a permanent faculty at Ingleburn in Sydney. They had just one cutting machine and one folding gluing machine. A family-run operation, Zakpak hoped, like many small businesses, to grow large enough to expand it more to put on more staff and expand its operations. Now, the cardboard box manufacturing industry is significant because such a large share of products come packaged in cardboard. Indeed, some have even argued that if you want to understand the output of the overall economy, if you want a leading indicator, then you should look at the output of cardboard box manufacturers. If people aren't buying boxes, the theory goes, they're not buying products. At the time when Zakpak began, the Australian cardboard box market was worth around $2 billion. Not surprisingly, Zakpak's management wanted a slice of the action. They didn't expect to become billionaires, but they did figure that if they worked hard and played by the rules, they'd be able to expand their operation. Unfortunately for Zakpak, others had different ideas. Between them, two companies, Visy and Amcor, controlled over 90% of the cardboard box market. They weren't merely large, they were actively colluding. Over a five-year period, from 2000 to 2005, senior representatives of the two firms began a series of clandestine meetings. And in scenes reminiscent of spy thrillers, they met in hotels and motels, including the Rockman Regency Hotel in central Melbourne and the Tudor Motel in Box Hill. They made phone calls from public phones and prepaid mobiles and met up in parks, including Westfields Park in Templestowe and Myrtle Park in North Borwen. And the collusion went to the highest level of the firm, including a 2001 meeting at the All Nations Hotel in Richmond between the firm's two chief executives, Amcor's Russell Jones and Visy's Richard Pratt. Eventually, as happens in so many clandestine affairs, things broke down. Since the start of their collusion, Visy's market share had grown from 47 to 55% of the market, but Amcor's had shrunk from 45 to 36%. The end of 2004, Amcor went to the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and announced it was willing to confess its role in the collusion in exchange for immunity from prosecution. The ACCC took action, ultimately leading to a court judgment which imposed a $36 million fine on Visy for price fixing, the largest fine in Australian history at that time, and $2 million worth of fines for the individuals involved. The ACCC also sought a criminal conviction against Richard Pratt for providing false evidence. The charge was ultimately abandoned on account of his poor health, and Pratt passed away in 2009. A few years later, a class action brought by Maurice Blackburn on behalf of more than 1,000 businesses affected by price fixing led to Amcor and Visy paying out $97 million. In 2009, Chris Bowen, as Minister for Competition Policy and Consumer Affairs, criminalised cartel conduct with a jail term of up to 10 years. This put Australia in line with the United States, United Kingdom, Germany, Ireland, and Canada. Those involved in the cardboard box cartel were fortunate their cartel didn't operate a few years later, or they might have found themselves behind bars for serious cartel conduct. The combined market of Amcor and Visy is still large, 84%, but significantly down from the 91% that it was at the peak of the duopoly. What about Zacpac? Their Sydney factory is now expanded to 5 cutting machines and 4 folding gluing machines, far more computerised than when it began. Zacpac recently opened a second factory at Stapleton, the Gold Coast. In the past few years, their business has grown at an annual rate of over 30%. Like a large tree that overshadows the saplings around it, firms that abuse their market power prevent newer competitors from growing. They hurt entrepreneurs and can reduce the scope for innovation. Consumers suffer through higher prices, lower quality, and less choice. But some of the benefits of market power invariably go to the people who run the firms. At the height of his secret meeting at the All Nations Hotel, Richard Pratt was the third wealthiest person in Australia. But aren't moguls who make their money through wielding market power the exception? What about the story of ingenious entrepreneurs creating value for their community? Well, you can point to some examples. You can think of Boost Juice founder Janine Allis, Red Balloon founder Naomi Simpson, Atlassian founders Mike Cannon-Brooks and Scott Farquhar, and Bing Lee founder Bing Lee. But alas, when it comes to the very wealthiest Australians, breakthrough innovators aren't the norm. Analysing how the wealthiest Australians made their money, Gigi Foster and Paul Frieders estimated that just 5 out of 200 had become rich primarily by inventing a new product or service. Far more commonly, they found the most affluent operated in industries with limited competition or significant reliance on government decisions. One analysis from the 1990s looked at the industries in which rich listers made their fortunes, and it concluded that about a quarter grew wealthy in an industry that was uncompetitive at the time. Since then, the problem may indeed have become worse. As BRW noted in 2012, there's a dearth of new, young, or entrepreneurial people on the latest BRW Rich List. The remainder of tonight's talk is structured as follows. I'll begin by talking about the extent to which the largest players dominate markets in Australia and how this has changed over time. Next, I'll talk about the relationship between uncompetitive markets and the rising inequality that Australia's experienced over the past generation. And I'll conclude by making some announcements about how a future Labor government will use competition law to help reduce inequality. So, like me, I expect you're always looking for economic games to play at your next dinner party. Here's one that I learned from John Daly, the CEO of the Grattan Institute. Try seeing how many industries your guests can name that are not dominated by a few large players. I can guarantee you, this is not a parlour game that's going to tie up the conversation all night. Moving from anecdote to data, I set out to look at market concentration across the Australian economy, but it turns out that it's harder than you might think. Unlike the US Census Bureau, the Australian Bureau of Statistics doesn't compile data on the market share of large firms. So instead, I was left to rely on private market research. And what follows, I'll present data drawn from IBIS World Industry Reports, from which I was able to compile comparable data for over 400 industries. All estimates are from 2016 and represent the share of industry revenues. And it provides, with over 400 industries, a fairly complete picture of the Australian economy. So to take a few examples of heavily concentrated markets, in department stores, newspapers, banking, health insurance, supermarkets, domestic airlines, internet service providers, baby food, beer and soft drinks, the big four control more than 4/5 of the market. The big four control more than 2/3 of the market in petrol retailing, telecommunications, credit unions, cinemas, liquor retailing, bottled water and fruit juice. And the big four account for more than half the market in pharmaceuticals, pharmacies, hardware, gyms, snack food, magazines, news agents and international airlines. And the data also do give a few answers for that dinner party game. If you want industries where the big four account for less than 1/10 of the market, you could suggest car dealers, hairdressers, dentists and law firms. Construction on the IBIS World data also appears to be fairly unconcentrated, but that might be because IBIS World have created a broad category which might mask more concentrated submarkets. Now, to be a bit unwieldy to show you a chart with 400 industries, although I did try putting one together before this talk, so let me show you a chart of the largest 20 industries in Australia by total revenue. This is market concentration in the biggest 20 industries in Australia. I've shown you two standard measures of market concentration. What share of the market do the biggest four competitors have? What share of the market do the top two competitors have? And you can see here the most concentrated banking, supermarkets, iron ore mining, telecommunications, and the least concentrated of the big industries, legal services, construction and industrial building, commercial industrial building construction, education and training, and in this general construction category. Now, although there's no set rule for what constitutes a concentrated market, a market with a four-firm concentration ratio of more than 1/3, in other words, where the biggest four firms control more than 1/3 of industry revenues, is often considered to be concentrated. If that's your rule of thumb, then over half of the IBIS World industries are concentrated. Market concentration in Australia is a cradle-to-grave affair, running from baby food to funeral services. In the 400-plus industries covered, the unweighted average market share of the largest four firms is 41%. In the figures you see on the screen here, showing the largest 20 industries, the market concentration is similar, 43%. Now, international comparisons are somewhat clouded by definitional differences, but it is worth noting that a recent analysis looking at 893 industries in the United States found that the largest four firms averaged across those industries controlled 33% of the market, suggesting that the US market is considerably less concentrated than the Australian one. Now, it's possible that US analysis is defining markets more broadly, or that the particular markets I've been able to study are more highly concentrated, but I think on its face, these data suggest that large Australian firms are more dominant in our markets than large US firms are in US markets. Now, by way of comparison, This next picture looks at 12 markets for which I was able to get a four-firm concentration index for both the United States and Australia, as close as I could come to an apples-to-apples comparison. Now, there's three of these markets, pharmacies, bottled water and beer, where the Australian market is either less concentrated or about as concentrated as the US one. But then there's nine of the 12 in which Australia has more concentrated markets than the US. The differences are largest for liquor retailing, where the top four US firms have just 10%, compared to the top four Australian firms with 78%. Supermarkets, where the concentration ratio in the US is 31%, but in Australia, 91%. Petrol, where the big four in the US control just 14% of the market, but the big four in Australia control 70% of the market. And that cardboard manufacturing example that I started with, where in the US, the big four control 36% of the market, Australia, 88% of the market. Now, I admit, the United States is an imperfect benchmark for Australia. Its population is 13 times larger than ours. But analyses focused on particular sectors have also sometimes suggested that Australia has more highly concentrated markets than the typical advanced country. The 2012 Finkelstein Media Inquiry found that across 26 countries, Australia was the only one in which the leading press company accounted for more than half the daily newspaper circulation. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission's 2008 Grocery Inquiry found that, quote, the lack of incentives for Coles and Woolworths to compete strongly across the board on prices reflects the high level of concentration in the industry and frequent monitoring of competitors' prices. Evidence indicates that if one player attempts to lead prices down, the other will follow, making it extremely difficult for either to win significant numbers of consumers through an aggressive pricing strategy. That inquiry compared our market with other countries and noted that, quote, international comparisons show that market structures vary widely between countries. In some OECD country member nations, including New Zealand and Austria, the grocery industry is dominated by two participants. The United Kingdom and Canada have a large number of retailers, though there's one clear leader in each country. And it should be noted that while in recent years we've seen more price competition among Australian supermarkets, that period has also seen the Australian supermarket majors remain among the most profitable supermarkets on the planet. In the case of banking, this figure here shows a comparison across advanced countries covering the period 2009 to 2013 with, just to confuse you, a three-firm concentration index. This suggests that in that period, our banking sector was slightly more concentrated than the OECD average, with Australia ranking 15th most concentrated of 33 countries. Now, another piece of evidence on Australian market concentration can be seen from looking at the largest firms on the Australian share market. The combined revenue of the 10 largest Australian firms, ANZ, the Commonwealth Bank, NAB, Westpac, Wesfarmers, Woolworths, AMP, Australian Super, Rio, and BHP, constitutes a fifth of the Australian economy. The 10 largest firms are a fifth of the economy. Is market concentration increasing? Well, in the United States, economic census data shows that since the late 1990s, two-thirds of US markets have experienced an increase in concentration. Across those nearly 900 markets I talked about before in the US study, the share of the big four rose from 26% in 1997 to 33% in 2012. Now, the available data, the data that are available to me, don't allow a parallel analysis for Australia. But there is some evidence that particular industries have become more concentrated. Let me give you a few examples. In supermarkets, Australia has benefited from the entry of Aldi and Costco. But since 2008, the market share of Coles and Woolworths has risen from 60% to 73%. In banking, the 2008 acquisition of St George by Westpac constituted a merger between the third and fifth largest banks in Australia. It depends on how you define the markets, but Westpac's market share went from somewhere in the range of 12 to 17% to somewhere in the range of 19 to 25%, according to the ACCC's public competition assessment. In 2013, you had a joint venture which saw Virgin Airlines acquire 60% of Tiger. Virgin's market share was 30%, Tiger's was 2%. In the case of meat processing, the 2011 merger between Tees Brothers Holdings and Cargill led to increased market concentration, although meat processing turns out to be a market that's fairly hard to be precise about the extent of concentration. In bottled drinks, the acquisition of Asahi, which owns Schweppes of P&N Beverages, removed a competitor which was well known for supplying beverages at the lower end of the price spectrum. In bottled water, Schweppes went from 9 to 19%. In fruit juice, Schweppes went from 5 to 16%. And among internet service providers, the TPG merger with iiNet increased iiNet's share of fixed broadband services from 15% to 27%. Now, an exception to this general trend is fuel retailing. In 2006, the top four accounted for 79% of the market. That's down to 70% in the most recent year. Another way we can look at competition is rather than measuring the whales, to count the minnows. So in this analysis, I've used Australian Bureau of Statistics figures to look both at the number of firms in an industry and how that industry's gross value added has changed. And you can see at the very top there that from 2011-12 to 2014-15, the number of firms operating across all industries actually fell by 1%, while total firm value added increased by 11%. Output up a tenth, number of firms smaller than it was. And in some industries, that drop's particularly pronounced. In mining, you had a 2% drop in the number of firms, despite a 38% increase in gross value added. In retail, hiring, and real estate services, the number of firms increased 3%, but against a gross value added increase of 37%, 10 times as large. In retail trade, you saw the number of firms fall 8%, while value added increased 13%. So, as you can see from that analysis, the long tail of small and medium-sized businesses has shortened somewhat in recent years. So what might explain the observed degree of market concentration in Australia? The most obvious is the Australian market size and proximity to international markets. As ACCC Chair Rod Sims has observed, Australia has many markets that are highly concentrated, which is perhaps not surprising given the relative size of our population. But that doesn't explain why our markets should have become more concentrated. Since the turn of the century, Australian population growth has been among the fastest in the advanced world. Incomes per person have also risen, although they've been a bit stagnant in recent years. If all that mattered were market size, there should be less market concentration in Australia, not more. But a range of factors have pushed in the opposite direction. As the Council of Economic Advisers in the United States recently noted, the causes underlying a possible decrease in competition and corresponding increase in market power aren't clear, but candidate explanations include efficiencies associated with scale, increases in mergers and acquisition activity, firms crowding out existing or potential competitors, either deliberately or through innovation, and regulatory barriers to entry, such as occupational licensing, that have restricted the entry of new firms into a variety of markets. Now, the Institute for Mergers, Acquisitions and Alliances helpfully tracks merger activity in Australia all the way back to 1992. Over that period, the Institute reports that the number of mergers has risen from just 394 in 1992 to 1,460 in 2015. The value of those mergers has gone in US dollars from $12 to $117 billion. Merger activity peaked in 2007, when Australia saw over 3,000 mergers with a total value of over $300 billion. And worldwide, the Institute estimates that in the past three decades, there's been almost a tenfold increase in the number and the value of mergers. Now, admittedly, not all merger activity will result in increased market concentration. You have to think about the counterfactual. It might be that one of the firms fails altogether. In other cases, it could be that the merging companies aren't competitors. But in general, I think we'd say that mergers increase market concentration. And a similar pattern can be seen in new business formation. As I noted earlier, the total number of businesses in Australia fell by 1% over the period back to 2011. And as you might imagine, there's a lot of churn in the business sector. Australia has about 2 million businesses, and every year about 10 to 15% start up and about 10 to 15% shut down. So in principle, that decline in the number of firms that I showed you before, the 1% decline, could be driven in two ways. It could either be more exits or it could be fewer entrants. But in practice, the main trend hasn't been business collapse. In fact, business exits have fallen slightly. It's been a slowing of new business formation. From 2011 to 2015, the rate of new business formation in Australia fell 2%. And over time, fewer new businesses is likely to lead to more market concentration. All the way back since the 1950s, services have steadily increased their share of the economy. As a higher proportion of our economy becomes weightless, the challenge of concentrated markets becomes greater still. In information technology industries, some early commentators had speculated that market concentration might be lower because barriers of entry were lower and switching costs were lower as well. But in many sectors, this now looks to be a forlorn hope. Google dominates search. Apple dominates smartphones. Facebook and Twitter dominate social media. Amazon and Alibaba are key players in online retailing. In the sharing economy, Uber and Airbnb have a large share of their respective markets. Competitors struggle to make inroads against these large firms due to a combination of intellectual property, network effects, and merger activity. And ironically, the best hope for consumers is probably that the steady expansion of platforms like Facebook and Google is eventually going to bring them into competition with one another, have them treading on one another's toes and creating new competition. Let me turn now to inequality. I confess to have come somewhat late to the argument that a lack of competition might be a significant driver of inequality. In 2013, I wrote a book, Battlers and Billionaires, which launched in Melbourne alongside Father Bob, who told his stories about his experiences of inequality. And that sketched out the evidence that inequality has risen since the late 1970s. Over that period, Australia's seen greater inequality in wages, and here I'm just showing you real wages for the bottom tenth, the middle and the top tenth. More inequality in household income, more inequality in top income shares, and if you want the authoritative figures now, you'll have to speak to Roger Wilkins, and more inequality in top wealth shares. Inequality in Australia today is as high as it's been in three quarters of a century, if you exclude that Korean War world boom. However, when it came to talking about the drivers of inequality, Battlers and Billionaires focused on union membership, top tax rates, technology, globalisation, education. I made only passing mention of uncompetitive markets. But I was first persuaded that the lack of competition might be important when I read Tony Atkinson's magisterial 2015 book, Inequality, What Can Be Done? That book looks at the interplay between competition and inequality, both at how concentrated markets can lead to a more concentrated distribution of income and how competition policy should be different in a high inequality society than in a low inequality society. As we teach our undergraduates, increased market power leads to more producer surplus. In an era of high unionisation, some of this surplus would probably have been shared with shop floor employees. But as the power of organised labour has waned, this becomes less prevalent. Indeed, modern-day market power tends to benefit shareholders and top executives at the expense of consumers. Because both capital owners and senior executives are wealthier than the median person, market power tends to increase inequality. A similar conclusion flows from Thomas Piketty's model of inequality, in which he models inequality as rising when the rate of return to capital, R, exceeds the rate of economic growth, G. As you'll know, the market equilibrium under monopoly is one in which prices are higher, output is lower, and profits are higher than under perfect competition. Therefore, an increase in market power is likely to both increase the rate of return to capital, increase R, and to slow the rate of economic growth, to decrease G. David Dyan, in his analysis of the US economy, has noted that since the 1980s, greater number of mergers have been approved by antitrust agencies, leading him to suggest the existence of an easier regulatory burden in the US over recent decades. Now, one way this might occur is if the number of regulatory staff didn't expand alongside the massive increase in merger numbers that I told you about before. But Dyan concludes that as a result of easier mergers, quote, monopolies drive inequality. Executives and Wall Street traders make astronomical incomes while wages are squeezed. Post-merger price increases, from healthcare to cable TV service to airline tickets, translate into a decline in real wages. Big mergers also encourage reduction in actual wages when consolidation produces layoffs and limits avenues for employment. And though high skills are supposedly a defence against wage cuts, cartel behaviour by Silicon Valley firms to prevent raiding each other's workers kept wages for coders and engineers lower than they otherwise would have been. Suppliers to platform monopolies experience a price crunch across the spectrum, reducing their own profits and funnelling them to the biggest firms where they pass to executives. And Dyan quotes Stiglitz. High concentration in the PC platform market with Microsoft gives rise to the richest person in the country. Monopoly increases wealth at the top, and for average Americans, real wages decrease. Similarly, an analysis of American markets in The Economist magazine notes the lack of competition in many sectors and points out high profits can deepen inequality in various ways. The pool of income to be split among employees could be squeezed. Consumers might pay too much for goods. Now, it's sometimes thought that monopoly power ultimately benefits consumers by spurring innovation. And while that's theoretically possible, it's also easy to think of examples in which market power reduces social welfare, even in innovative industries. For example, through exclusive contracts that lock in inferior technologies. And part of the reason that I opened with a story about a cardboard box cartel is that it's difficult to see in that industry how the duopoly's market power encourage greater innovation. At a macroeconomic level, others have suggested that the US economy is exhibiting the hallmarks of excessive market power. Paul Krugman observes that, quote, profits are near record highs, thanks to substantial decline in the percentage of GDP going to workers. You might think these high profits imply high rates of return to investment, but corporations themselves certainly don't see it that way. Their investment in plant, equipment and technology, as opposed to mergers and acquisitions, hasn't taken off. Even though they can raise money, whether through issuing bonds or selling stocks, more cheaply than ever before. As Krugman points out, if high corporate profits reflect growing monopoly power, then the result would be what we see. A US economy with high profits but low investment, even in the face of very low interest rates and high stock prices. Similarly, Larry Summers has suggested that his theory of secular stagnation might be partially driven by increasing market power. Like Krugman, Summers notes that the rate of profitability in the United States is at a near record high level, as the share of corporate revenue going to capital. The stock market's valued very high by historical standards, as measured by Tobin's Q ratio of the market value of non-financial corporations to the value of their tangible capital. And the ratio of the market value of equities in the corporate sector to GDP is also unusually high. A high rate of return to old capital would imply that there's a high payoff to investment in new capital. But as Summers points out, business investments either in line with cyclical conditions or a little weaker than would be predicted by cyclical conditions. He suggests one way of reconciling it. He says it could be that higher profits don't reflect increased productivity of capital, but instead reflect an increase in monopoly power. If monopoly power increased, one would expect to see higher profits, lower investment as firms reduced output, and lower interest rates as the demand for capital was reduced. That, he says, is exactly what we've seen in the US in recent years. So until now, this talk might have had something of the flavour of the sort of talk I would have given as an economics professor back in the old days. And in delivering that kind of talk, I would have moved now to wave my hands about various possible policy responses. But things are slightly different today. I'm Labor's Shadow Minister for Competition, so I'm actually really pleased to be able to announce how a Shorten government would begin to address the problems I've outlined. Labor has a strong history of consumer-focused policy reform. Labor introduced the Prices Justification Act in 1973, the Trade Practices Act in 1974, National Competition Policy in 1995, and under Craig Emerson, the Australian Consumer Law in 2011. In the current parliamentary term, we've supported most, though not all, of the Harper Review proposals. We've also urged the government to go further. My colleagues Chris Bowen, Michelle Rowland and I have proposed a policy that improve access by small business who are currently deterred from pursuing legal action by the prospect of large adverse cost orders. But we don't think that the government's focused enough on inequality. Ian Harper's 548-page competition review ranges very broadly, but it contains only a handful of mentions of inequality, most in passing. So tonight I announce that a future Labor government will ensure that competition policy does more to ameliorate the growing economic gap in our society. That work complements other work we're making to tackle inequality in other areas. In social policy, Jenny Macklin's released a seminal report, Growing Together, Labor's Agenda for Tackling Inequality. In the workplace, a deep concern over inequality is one of the reasons Labor's committed to maintaining penalty rates. In schools policy, our commitment to needs-based funding is grounded in egalitarian values. In the area of competition, we'll make four specific changes. First, we'll amend Section 76 of the Competition and Consumer Act to allow a court to impose higher penalties for conduct that targets or disproportionately impacts disadvantaged Australians, or apply lower penalties if firms have provided adequate compensation to those affected. Consumer rip-offs are always reprehensible, but they have a different impact on the most affluent than they do on the most vulnerable. To a high-income consumer, losing a few thousand dollars might be an annoyance. To a low-income consumer, losing a few thousand dollars could be life-changing. Ripping off the poorest is disgusting, and we're going to provide courts with the power to act as they see fit. Second, we'll include a requirement in the Competition and Consumer Act that the ACCC prioritise investigations of conduct that targets or disproportionately impacts disadvantaged Australians. The growth in inequality makes it vital to enact a specific legislative requirement for the competition regulator to put the most vulnerable first. Third, we'll task a government to investigate the impacts of increased market concentration on income inequality in Australia, and produce policy recommendations on how the negative effects of market concentration can be mitigated. That kind of high-level exercise will doubtless explore ways that highly concentrated markets widen the gap, as well as suggesting practical ways in which competition and consumer laws can reduce inequality. And fourth, we'll encourage states and territories to include competition principles in planning and zoning legislation, as recommended by the Harper Review, with a specific focus on shortfalls of appropriately zoned land for key services in disadvantaged communities. Traditionally, inner city zoning issues have attracted a disproportionate share of public attention, leaving zoning and outer suburbs too neglected. Ensuring states and territories provide proper attention to outer suburbs and applying appropriate competition principles is critical to the sustainability of those communities and to addressing inequality in them. After a generation of rising inequality, and with the evidence pointing towards increased market concentration, it's vital to look at ways of ensuring that competition works for the neediest. Together, these policies will help tilt the playing field towards the most disadvantaged. The past generation has been very kind to those at the top of the distribution. As you can see from the chart before you, the top 1% share has doubled. The top 0.1% share has tripled. Never in Australian history has such a large share of the population owned a private jet, a private helicopter, a Porsche, a Maserati. But at the same time, a significant share of the population is doing it tough. As a result of the Melbourne Institute's HILDA survey, we know that nearly a quarter of Australians say they couldn't raise $3,000 in an emergency without doing something drastic. One in five families say they can't afford a week's holiday away from home, just once a year. One in eight say they can't afford dental care. One in 20 say they can't afford Christmas presents for family and friends. Looking at industry data across 400 markets, Australian product markets, to me, appear pretty highly concentrated. Applying the rule of thumb that a market's concentrated, if the biggest four firms control a third or more, over half all industries are concentrated markets. Concentrated markets aren't the only driver of rising inequality, but it seems likely they've played a part in the steady rise in inequality over the past generation. Engendering more competition in Australia wouldn't just have efficiency benefits, but most likely equity impacts as well. Similarly, on the policy side, competition in consumer laws will never be the only way in which governments seek to fight inequality, but they should be enjoined to the battle. By tilting competition in consumer laws towards the most disadvantaged, it might be possible to ameliorate the rising gap between the rich and the rest. Thanks very much.